This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. On the Appalachian Trail, there's a phenomenon hikers call trail magic. It describes the happy surprises that hikers experience along the way. Could be a stranger giving you a ride to a grocery store or showing up at a trail crossing to see that a meal has been prepared for you. Joe Lyles hiked the Appalachian Trail when he was in his late 50s, and in many ways, trail magic and the form of community that he found among his fellow through hikers reflected his lifetime of work as an artist, activist, and teacher. Joe taught art at the North Carolina School of Science and Math for 28 years before he hit the trail, and before all of that, he worked on behalf of Native American rights as a member of the American Indian Movement. So there's lots to talk about this hour as we meet my guest, Joe Lyles. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a number of journeys that we'll talk about today, extraordinary experiences in some ways, and yet all coming from a very ordinary background. Tell us about growing up in North Carolina.
Well, I grew up in a little town, Wadesboro, North Carolina, which is the county seat of Anson County. Oftentimes I'm offended in life because people ask me where I'm from. I tell them Wadesboro, and they say, well, I've never heard of it. And I considered Wadesboro to be a very important place and feel so lucky to have grown up there in what I consider the heyday of that town.
And you have described that as a kind of an idyllic upbringing.
Well, it was idyllic for me in that I had the best of both lives living in town, and my father ran a clothing store in town called the Lyles Company that my grandfather ran before him. So I had the urban experience, well, if you can call Wadesboro urban.
It was the county seat after all.
That's right.
All right.
But I also had the rural experience because my family for many generations owned a farm outside of town and probably started out as a cotton farm. But by the time I came along, it was a cattle farm. So I worked with my dad and my brothers and I mended fences and rounded up cattle and went fishing in all the farm ponds. I did have a sister come along, but I was already grown at 10 years of age. But
and you knew all there was to know about what were you thinking about then taking over the family business? Had that been part of your thinking?
Not really. You know, my father kind of got roped into that. His dream was not becoming the owner and operator of a mercantile. His dream was a lot more creative than that. I always heard that he wanted to be a lawyer. He went to Davidson, but he got, after graduating, his dad and mom put the squeeze on him and said, you need to come home and you need to run the store. Hmm. That wasn't in his plan. He did that. He did that and sacrificed for his family. And consequently, I was able to go to college. I was able to have a good life. And the story goes, my father never borrowed a dime.
It's a wonderful life, then. It sounds like you went to NC State. You went to the landscape architecture program.
I did. I had the preconception I was going to be an architect, but when I got into design school, that gave me a phenomenal visual arts education. I learned about this program in the landscape program that was called advocacy. Now, advocacy meant that you used your skills as a landscape architect to work with communities of people. So I did everything from helping organize the first Apple Chill Fair in Chapel Hill to, strangely enough, I met American Indian students at NC State, kind of fell in with them, you know, enjoyed their company. They said they wanted to learn about modern pan-Indian culture. And I said I knew about that because I'd been working out at Philmont Scout Ranch in New Mexico, and I'd met a lot of Indian people out there, fell in love with their music. And so that made my connection with the Lumbee people of North Carolina happen.
And this would have been about when?
This would have been in 69, 70, 71, 72. So it, you know, that's kind of what brought me into to working with Indian people. And the best thing about it is I got college credit for it because I was in the advocacy program. I designed powwow posters. I did festival planning, helped organize the first Lumbee powwow in 1971 in the summer on July 4th, and just got back last night from the child of that, the what that has turned into is the Lumbee powwow of the spring moon.
And, of course, this was a time when the Native Americans' rights movement was growing, the American Indian movement centered in Minneapolis, in Minnesota.
Yeah. I graduated from State. I had some professors there that told me that they had the ideal graduate program for me to go into, and it was at the University of Michigan. So they actually paid my way to go up there. They were so interested in me going there. And it was another program of advocacy. It was in the Environmental Education Department of the School of Natural Resources, and it was called the Advocacy Program, where people would work with various communities on environmental issues. It was, in retrospect, the beginning of the environmental justice movement in this country. They just hadn't coined that phrase yet. So we worked with communities all over the state of Michigan and the Midwest. And lucky for me, I got permission to go into my graduate studies working with the Indian people of Michigan now, helping them organize cultural events.
And you eventually, though, did come to work with the American Indian Movement team.
True. You know, my first job offer as a graduate student was to come to the Red Schoolhouse that was located in St. Paul, Minnesota. So it's an urban school, to come there and work for the Red Schoolhouse as their art teacher. It was a school operated by the American Indian Movement, AIM, as it was known, a school that was one of several what they called survival schools. It was a school designed to give Indian young people an education in survival skills for the then 20th century, but also teach them about their culture, about their language, their religion.
This is interesting. Forgive me for interrupting, but fascinating, because the movement was so based and rooted in the sense of recapturing American Indian culture for ourselves as Native Americans.
Right.
You had no Native American ancestry. How were you invited to that particular party?
Well, it's a strange story. And a humorous side of that is when I first arrived on the scene, everybody thought I was an FBI agent, that I'd been sent in as a plant to spy on the American Indian Movement, because this was right after the takeover of Wounded Knee, South Dakota, and there was a lot of suspicion going on. I had to work very hard to gain trust and overcome those suspicions. But the strange story, the mystical story about this possible connection of why I was drawn into this happened there. We were a cultural kind of action place, and we were invited, our school was invited all over the upper Midwest and Canada to make presentations on Indian culture and to explain how we did this thing of combining modern teaching and traditional teaching. And I went to the spiritual conference with Red Schoolhouse up in Manitoba, in Canada, and after one of the spiritual ceremonies they had, this old elder from the Cree Nation came up to me and said, "I learned something about you in that ceremony." And I went, "Really? What was that?" And he said, "I learned that one of your ancestors was involved in a tragic accident with an Indian man. And I wasn't able to find out any more than that. That's what he told me. And I'd never heard anything about this. So when I went home for Christmas that year, I asked my dad, you know, I said, Dad, has anything like this ever gone on before? You know, some kind of accident involving one of my ancestors and an Indian man. And I told him about what had happened in Manitoba. And he says, you know, it's funny you should mention that because I just found some documents that tell about your grandfather going back seven generations, a fellow by the name of Ephraim Lyles, who in the border area between North Carolina and Virginia was out hunting deer one day with his long rifle and spotted what he thought was a deer, shot the deer, went over to collect his prize, and to his horror found an Indian man lying there with a deer hide over his back, a deer head on his head with antlers and a bow and arrow. The Indian man was hunting for deer too, but Ephraim mistook him for a deer. The story goes, this document revealed that Ephraim did not kill that Indian man right then. I mean, he was badly wounded, and Ephraim took him to the closest Indian village, explained what had happened. They let Ephraim go, but when Ephraim got home, he said to his wife, and I think he maybe had two small children at that time, he says, "We're heading out of here. I think there might be trouble." He went all the way to southeastern North Carolina, PD River, and that's where I grew up.
Stay with us on The State of Things. My conversation with Joe Lyle continues after this. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, today talking with Joe Lyles. He spent his adult life working as a community builder of sorts, both with Native Americans in the North Country and at the School of Science and Math here in Durham, North Carolina, as an art teacher. He just told us about his work in Minnesota and about an extraordinary story where after a spiritual exercise, I guess a kind of a was it a dance or a spiritual?
A ceremony.
A spiritual mm-hmm. ceremony. A Native American participant said he'd seen an incident from your life, your ancestors, and it turned out to be kind of accurate. What did you make of that when you went back and talked to your father?
Well, it didn't hit me right at first, but it evolved in my thinking that maybe this incident that happened with Ephraim and the Indian man was what drew me into, at a very early age, what drew me into American Indian communities. Maybe this was meant to be. Maybe I was living my life to set something straight that Ephraim did. Ephraim basically unintentionally threw things out of balance by taking a life by accident. And maybe my life then, or at least part of my life, is helping set that straight, helping restore balance. And that's what Indian philosophy is all about.
Does that change things for you as a teacher, just in what you were doing? You got into it and you were successful. You were doing the teaching, right, without knowing that, without thinking. Now you think, well, maybe there's a reason for this. Does it change the way you approach the work?
It that whole way of looking at the world, of looking for meaning beyond the surface, is one of the many things that I took away from Indian culture. And you know, those signs are around us all the time. You know, they come in all kinds of forms, but the natural world, the Creator, is speaking to us constantly, giving us hints about how we should live our lives. And I am doing the best I can to open my eyes and my ears and my mind to those hints so I can live the best possible life.
Is art a vehicle for you to that kind of seeing?
Oh, absolutely. Art basically awakens your creative self to explore your feelings, your reactions to the world, your hopes for the future. It's basically a medium of introspection, and that's what I did with the Indian students in Minnesota. I had them look into their own lives and try to get meaning from that through their artwork. And that's what I did back here, returning to North Carolina and working for the North Carolina School of Science and Math right here in Durham. I was actually living right across the street from the school, which was the old Watts Hospital at the time. And I heard a school was coming in. I said, you know, they've got to have an art teacher. You know, it's called the School of Science and Math, but they've got to have art. And I went knocking on their door and, you know, was lucky enough to get an interview. And lo and behold, I ended up being the first teacher ever hired at the North Carolina School of Science and Math, which I thought was pretty strange that the art teacher was hired first.
That's a great story. The art teacher first hired at the School of Science and Math.
Yeah.
So it obviously wasn't the job that brought you back to Durham because you didn't have that yet. What did bring you here?
Well, I was still working at Red Schoolhouse. I always intended on coming back, and I learned that in a ceremony up there. In Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, I was in this spiritual ceremony, and in that ceremony, I saw this kind of blue light and closed my eyes, and I saw three stars and a sheaf of grass, of a bundle of some type of grass, and I didn't know what it meant. But then I figured out that it was a symbolic way of telling me the things that had to come to me before I was able to return to my home in North Carolina. And one by one, those things came to me. The stars represented three physical items that came to me in rather mysterious ways. They were actually turned out to be rocks of different kinds, rocks that were used to tie on the head of a water drum that was used in the ceremonies up there. But I always wondered, I kind of got into a holding pattern. I wondered, you know, what's this sheaf of grass supposed to be? Where is that? When is that going to happen? I'm ready to go home. But I couldn't go home. And I was at an Indian encampment ceremony in Wisconsin. And at the last day of the ceremony, I saw this Indian woman walking across the field, and she was carrying a bundle of grass. And it hit me right then that she was coming to give me that grass. And she walked right up to me and said, "I don't know why I'm supposed to do this, but this is a bundle of sweet grass. It's what my people, the Ojibwe people, believe is the hair of Mother Earth. And we braid it in this way because it signifies the hair of our mother. I was told in the ceremony last night to give you this." Once that happened, I knew I was supposed to return to North Carolina.
Did you say anything to her?
Well, I shook her hand. I hugged her. I probably shed a tear or two. And I said, "Miigwech," which means thank you in Ojibwe.
It was interesting that you felt you had to wait. What was it, because, in a sense, the oracle had spoken and you dare not work against or act against the oracle? Or was there something else that was sort of in the way and coincidentally until you got this thing?
Well, I think it was the Creator's way of telling me that I hadn't made all of my contribution yet. Mm-hmm. There was more that I had to give.
But you felt that you had to, in a sense, obey the dream. That
absolutely.
Until I get the grass, I can't go home, not that these other things.
I might be opening up tragedy if I disobeyed that.
So you got back and you teach art here. Was it different for you? How was it different, if so, teaching here?
Well, it was the same kind of mission in that using art to help my students achieve balance. And at the School of Science and Math, it's a pretty, intense place. It's a pressure-filled place. And I used art there as, in a way, therapy to help the students find balance, to help them kind of, I called it a pressure release valve, where they could blow off steam. But I also help them, you know, look into their own lives, decide, or, you know, even sometimes discover what's important to me and how can I express this through my artwork. I, again, felt attracted to the American Indian students that came to that school. That school serves the entire population of North Carolina and strives to represent all people of North Carolina. So there's always been American Indian kids there at that school. I kind of was the unofficial counselor for them and took them in and was a support person for them. We had meetings in the art studio at night, and I started teaching a lot of them things about their Indian culture that they didn't even know from their Indian communities here in North Carolina. I taught them how to sing, and we had wonderful times together.
And you have, in fact, you're part of a group, right, called Third Degree Burn?
Well, the group is called Southern Sun. It's a modern-day contemporary Indian singing group. It's called a drum, and drum is much used in terminology there as we would use a choir in a church. You call the group of singers a drum, but it's really more than just a drum. It's a group of singers. The drum is used as percussion to give the beat, called the heartbeat of Mother Earth, to tell the dancers when to put their feet on the earth as they're dancing. And it's a group of men and women. It's an outgrowth of the first group I got involved with as a college student back at NC State. You know, those Lumbees I worked with back then, we formed a group called Lumbees and Friends. And that was the first Indian singing group that that I was ever aware of on the East Coast, bringing the music back, bringing the traditional music back. And Southern Sun grew out of that. Interestingly, we named the group Southern Sun, S-O-N, at first, because we all considered ourselves as Lumbee Indians, and we had all the tribes of North Carolina represented at that point, Halawasa Pony, Waccamaw Suwan, Cherokee, Maharans. We had singers from all tribes come through there. But women started expressing interest in this, and there is a place for women in this music, and it's a very beautiful place. So the women who were phenomenal contributors to this group, they said, well, what about us? You call this group Southern Sun, and we're not sons, we're daughters. So we changed the name of the group to Southern Sun, S-U-N, and that's what we do today.
You know, but again, I'm curious about your inclusion, because also some of these works, I think, and perhaps not on this list, this particular CD, we're going to hear some in just a second, are considered spiritual music. And in that, and in many cases, Native groups are a little sensitive about having non-natives participating in spiritual song. Was this ever a problem for you?
Well, it's the same issue I've worked with my whole life, you know, about breaking down walls, dissolving suspicion, and earning trust. And I find that that is possible to do. It takes patience, but American Indian people are a very giving and open people. That has somewhat been a handicap to them, because they were so welcoming and, you know, they were taken advantage of. But so there is some rightfully some suspicion, but I'm very lucky that I've been able to be accepted in that community, and I'm eternally grateful for it.
Well, I want to play a sample now from the Southern Sun Singers. This I think this CD recorded around 2005, 2006,
that's right.
So 2005, and this is a song called Intertribal. Thank you. There is a little section of intertribal from an album called Third Degree Burn by the Southern Sun Singers, and one of the participants is my guest this hour, Joe Lyles, who is on that album. So what's happening in that song?
Well, it is a song that is written in the structure of the war song of American Indian people. And war songs is that is somewhat of a misnomer. That is a European title for that music that the first Westerners into this country from Europe, they called that music war songs. But those songs are many of them contain words, and those words sometimes are about war deeds. But those words most times are about the stories and history of the individual tribe. You know, sometimes the words in the song can be about a woman in the tribe that was a great cook, or a man in the tribe that was a great hunter. And it mentions that person by name and tells the deed, and that way those stories can stay alive. So the music today, the music that Southern Sun does today, respects that traditional structure and keeps the songs, you know, kind of like the blues or the blues, but the blues always have that kind of bluesy structure to them. This kind of music has that same traditional Indian music structure, to where I think that if an Indian man was or woman was able to come back from 400 years ago and listen to this music, they would understand it, they would appreciate it, and they would even say, good one.
But this is not specifically a traditional song. This is one that was created
It was composed by our group today, done in the traditional fashion. Yeah. So Indian people are an evolving people. They are not stuck in the past, you know, just like going back to Red Schoolhouse. You've got to keep your past alive, all the traditions, your language, but you still have to live in the modern world. So these songs are composed today by groups all over the country. They even have a term called Top 40, where Indian people have Top 40 songs, and they're popular all over the country. And I'm honored that some of the songs of Southern Sun are sung by other tribes in other parts of the country.
So there you are, teaching art at the School of Science and Math, keeping a native culture alive and moving it forward as part of the ongoing tradition. And then you decide, you know what, if I'm going to hike that Appalachian Trail, which had apparently been on your mind for some time, I better do it now. And right. You left the school.
I did, and that was a hard thing to do. I had the best teaching job in the world, the best students in the world. I had a great facility. I had wonderful colleagues with whom to work. Why would I want to leave all that? But I did want to hike the Appalachian Trail. I met my first thru-hikers taking my daughter backpacking on Mount Rogers in Virginia, and I saw a light in their eyes that I'd never seen before. I wanted to find that light. So I wanted to hit the trail before I got too old that I couldn't do it anymore.
So this has been with you for maybe a couple of decades by the time you...
That's right. I've been thinking about it a lot. And I figured out that I could actually retire with 30 years of service to the state if I work through the school year of 2007-2008. So I retired from the school, from the state of North Carolina, spent the summer and the fall kind of getting ready. And the thing that scared me the most about thinking about getting on the trail was, how was I going to survive the cold temperatures at the highest elevations during essentially the winter time? So in the winter before I headed out, every time it would get below freezing or in the 20s, I would take all my backpacking stuff and I would head out to the Eno River State Park And with permission and with a permit, I would camp. And I found out how to, you know, purify my water, how to, you know, cook my food, how to function when my fingers were so cold they hurt.
Little bit of prep, a little bit of training, and a little bit of trail magic is Joe Lyle's story. We're going to get more of your work on the trail. Joe Lyle's conservationist and a teacher, accomplished hiker who wrote a song while on the Appalachian Trail, and a couple of his former colleagues at the North Carolina School of Science and Math recorded it. So here are Scott Laird and Willie Painter to play us out of this segment with the hiker song. And when we come back, more with Joe Lyle. Stay tuned.
In that north state they call Maine, there's a place there that's not forgotten. For 2,200 miles I have come to Mount Katahdin. I am a hiker on the trail, the Appalachian, one and the same. It runs from Maine clear down to Georgia. It's from that trail I got my name. We are hikers on the trail.
This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio talking with Joe Lyle today. 28 years he taught at taught art at the North Carolina School of Math and Science. Then he left and hit the trail, the Appalachian Trail, hiked the whole thing. So tell us about sort of what happens on the trail, a little bit about your journey. You did a little bit of training. You started in Georgia in the winter. Yeah.
And they say that the best way to prepare for the trail is just to get on it and do it. Started on Springer Mountain, on the top of Springer Mountain. Actually, I had to climb 8.5 miles to get to the top of the trail. And I started there on March 9 of 2008. In nine, and you know, I planned in my own naive way. I said, you know, I can hike 10 miles a day, easy, for the start. Well, I started out, and the best I could do was maybe 8 miles a day. The trail was whooping me. You know, it's extreme ups and downs. I was never slept better in my life. At the end of the day, you know, heck, the sun would go down, and you'd just go to bed. I mean, sometimes I went to bed at 6:30, but I'd be up at dawn.
But that first week, how about putting that pack back on your shoulders?
Oh, my gosh. You know, there. I tried to get my weight of the pack down to 40 pounds, and I finally got it down to 35 pounds. I couldn't do any better than that. So I was always carrying, you know, like a big sack of dog food on my back, you know, the equivalent of that anyway, that contained, you know, my tent, my sleeping bag, my stove, my pot, my food, my rain gear.
Right.
And it was a humbling experience. You know, it taught me that I was rather insignificant in the world in terms of my importance, and that there was much more importance around me, surrounding me. You know, I'd come up to the top of a ridge and I'd look out and I would see mountains stretching away as far as the horizon, and I would not see one sign of civilization. And I felt pretty small at that time. I experienced a lot of rain at the start of the trail, and maybe even the first half of the trail. And I had this kind of, you know, attitude creeping in that was a holdover from my life back in Durham, was that the trail was conspiring against me, just like the traffic lights conspired against me back in Durham, that the trail was heaping misery on me, you know, with rain and slick tree roots and a blizzard. But I gradually started coming out of that, to where I recognized the trail as my ally and my friend instead of my enemy. As soon as that shift happened in me, it changed my whole way of looking at the trail and my whole way of looking at the life. I basically turned off the negative switch and I turned on the positive switch. And wonderful things started happening to me.
Is this part of what you call and what others call trail magic?
Yeah. You know, when I first experienced trail magic, it was like this big bearded guy at a crossroads where the trail crossed the road in Georgia. He was handing out Snickers bars. And I thought, man, that is really trail magic. But trail magic expanded in my awareness from there. Trail magic became the wonderful things that happen to you all the time on the trail. It could be a beautiful sunrise, a beautiful sunset. It could be surviving torrential rain and being happy through it. It could be wood thrushes singing to you in the morning. It could be somebody running into you at a trail crossing on the highway and giving you a meal. I experienced all kinds of just wonderful trail magic along the way.
As we're imagining ourselves on the trail now with our aches and pains and our blisters, and we're now in the rain that you've created for us, anybody handing out a Snickers bar might be, you know, you think, well, that's a welcome. But we've all been in that place where somebody's given us a Snickers bar and you say, you know, I really don't like Snickers. I'm kind of a Milky Way guy.
Right.
It's too bad that the only guy on the trail handing out candy is handing out the candy I don't like. But it's precisely that sort of orientation, I think,
right,
that you write about in your book and talk about, that is this way of not seeing the trail as the enemy and seeing yourself as conforming to it.
Right, right. And, you know, I was almost to the end of the trail. I had maybe 70 miles to go. I was in Maine, and I experienced some pain in my feet that day. You know, by that time, I was covering 20 miles a day. And when I took my shoes off that night and I looked at my feet, I was horror-struck. Because starting to form on the bottom of my feet were hundreds of just tiny, small blisters. And I'm going, man, I haven't had any blisters. What is happening to me? And I basically made a pledge that night. That night, you know, I was very troubled. I said, Creator, if you'll get me through this, I promise I will never complain again in my life. And the trail taught me that you can live through snow, you can live through rain, you can live through heat. And complaining doesn't do any good. You can't control what happens to you sometimes, but you can control your reaction to it. And that makes all the difference. And I am continuing to live up to that pledge of never complaining. Sometimes it comes close.
Do you feel like you're being tested?
I feel like I'm being constantly tested.
Let's see how Joe lives up to this one. Well, you had an experience right here in North Carolina, I think, Hot Springs, or was it a student maybe from Hot Springs?
Yeah, that was a profound piece of trail magic. I just experienced a blizzard on the trail. You know, well, it was, you know, 10 inches of snow. And previously that would have scared me to death. But I actually relished it. It was one of my most beautiful experiences, but I was still cold. And as the snow started to melt, I got wetter and I came into the town of Hot Springs, North Carolina. And I found that because of the snow, there were no vacancies in the town. All the hikers that were in town when the snow hit, they stayed. And all the hikers that were coming into town, they gobbled up all the places to stay. And, you know, I felt like, you know, a pilgrim with no room in the inn. I ran into some hikers on the street that said, well, there's this one expensive place down the road here next to the railroad tracks called the Iron Horse Station. And, man, it's a really nice place, but the rooms are way up there. But, man, I was so tired of hiking 18 miles that day, sometimes through knee-deep snow, that I didn't care how much it cost. I went to the Iron Horse Station. There was a little grill downstairs, and the bartender there, he was trying to manage everything, and he was a little overwhelmed. And he says, I got a room for you. Just take your pack upstairs and, you know, come on down, and we'll settle up. So he gave me the key. I go upstairs. I plug in my cell phone. Now, I did have a cell phone with me that I kept turned off, but I had that with me for emergencies. And you can get cell signals way on the high mountains. Plug that cell phone in, and it chimed. And I looked at the screen, and it says, "You have a voicemail message. Would you like to listen to it now or later?" I had never gotten a voicemail before. I didn't even know how to use a cell phone. So I pressed, "Yeah, I'll listen to it now." And a voice came on the, you know, my cell phone that said, "Mr. Lyles, this is Tyler Buckner. I was a student of yours back in the 90s, and I'm originally from the town of Hot Springs. I don't live there anymore. I have a business in Cincinnati, but I heard you were hiking the trail. I wanted to make sure you had a good time when you came through my hometown. So I've made some arrangements for you. If you get this message before you get to Hot Springs, just stop in the Iron Horse Station." I was aghast. How did Tyler know that I was here? You know, he says, continued, he says, "Go downstairs to the grill and ask the bartender to give you an envelope that I have left for you in the cash register." So I go down back downstairs. And I tell the bartender, "There's an envelope for me in the cash register." He looks at me like I've lost my mind. And he opens the cash register drawer, and he comes back and says, "There's nothing in there. There's no envelope in there." And I said, would you just pull up the money tray and see if there's anything underneath?" And he rolls his eyes, goes back to the cash register, lifts the money tray. There's a white envelope. It's got my name on it. He gives it to me. He makes sure he wants to see some ID. And I show him my driver's license. He gives me the envelope. I open it up. And it says, there's a letter in there. And it says, "This contains all the information to give Joe Lyles one free night stay at the Iron Horse Station, plus a tab in the grill for up to $100. A soak in the town's famous hot springs for up to four people, and foot massages for two people." So I was concerned about how expensive the room was. It turns out I didn't have to pay a dime for it. I had the night of my life. They had an open mic at the bar that night. I sang my trail song, and I hardly was able to even spend any of the money because I sang this song. All the hikers identified with it, and everybody wanted to buy me stuff afterwards. So Tyler was very generous. He gave me a $100 tab, and I spent $17.50.
When did he send the message?
You know, I don't know. I suppose I could research that and find it out, but it was a total coincidence.
But it had been sent well before you got there. You're
saying, oh yeah,
yeah, yeah, and then there you show up, down you come.
Yeah,
it's an amazing. So that's trail magic. Then you leave the trail at some point. I mean, you know, the trip ends. Does the magic end?
Well, how I left the trail was another example of trail magic. One of my students contacted me on the trail through email. And said, "I know you remember me. My name is Elizabeth Granger. It's now Elizabeth Granger Page, and my husband has a single propeller airplane, and we'd like to fly up to Maine and fly you back home over the Appalachian Trail when you finish." So Elizabeth and her husband, Dan, flew up to Maine, picked me up at the Millinocket airport, and flew me all the way back to Raleigh-Durham.
Wow.
But since I've returned, the trail magic continues to be a part of my life. And it may not be on the trail, but it's around me all the time. And it's, I think, because of that positive way of looking at the world. Now, I'm no perfect person, and I do have bouts of pessimism and negativity that come into my life at times, but I try to fight that off And I find that if I maintain that positive attitude about life, that those good things keep happening to me, that I am living my life the way the Creator would want me to live it, and I am going to maximize my contribution that I can make as a human being while I'm on the earth by thinking positive and bringing those magical occurrences into my life.
That's the maintenance part of it. But if you find that you are off the trail, do you have to do something to get it back?
Well, going back to what we were talking about earlier, it's all a matter of balance. So, you know, maintaining that balance through artwork, mm-hmm. through attending powwows, through dancing, through singing, and occasional returns to the trail for what we call trail therapy. It'll get you back.
Kind of brings you back and restores that that new way of seeing, that powerful way of
Absolutely.
Seeing. That comes from trail magic, and a kind of, I guess another way to put that is a social capital where people connect with people, and that sort of hospitality
yes.
really works.
And, it's a wonderful community.
So now, I've got about a minute and a half left, but I want to find out what you're doing because I know you're working with the Eno River Association now,
yes.
and that's pretty important to you, especially putting those calendars together.
Right. I'm on the board of directors of the Eno River Association, and one of the ways I contribute is to pull together a calendar for every year, and I work with other people doing that. And we last year, we worked on the 2012 calendar that's out there now called Everyone's Eno, and it's a solicitation, you know, to have people send in their pictures of the Eno River and their favorite memories of the Eno River, their poems, their short stories, and it was a very successful calendar for 2012, and now the call is out for 2013, and we are accepting photographs, written pieces at enoriver.org. So if you go to that website, enoriver.org, you will find out how you can contribute to next year's calendar. And one other thing I'm working on that I'm really excited about is I'm tracking all the old roads that go through the Eno River State Park. I'm literally finding old roads that were used in colonial times. And the reason there's so many of them out there in this area is because Hillsboro was the capital of North Carolina when North Carolina was really England. And all the roads went to the capital. So the Eno River State Park is right outside of Hillsboro. I'm having the time of my life figuring out how all these old roads forded the river and made their way to Hillsboro.
Finding the lost trails still, Joe Lyles. Fantastic. Good
Thank
to see you,
Frank.
Great to talk with you. Joe Lyles taught at the North Carolina School of Science and Math for 28 years. His book, Trail Magic, is about his hike of the Appalachian Trail. And you can see his artwork at joelyles.com, L-I-L-E-S. And that's the state of things for today. You find us at stateofthings.org. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.